Hey all, how's it going? Welcome back to The Forum, where science comes to socialize, the one and only podcast of the Institute on Science for Global Policy. I'm Aubrey, and I'll let my co-hosts introduce themselves.
Hi everyone, I'm Cleo. Thanks for joining us.
And I'm Daniela. We're glad to have you back and contributing to today's conversation on social media, hopefully. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at ISGB Forum. Aubrey, did I read your email right? Are we discussing another debate from ISGP's Food Security and Diet-Linked Public Health Challenges conference? I feel like we've been talking diet and nutrition a ton lately.
Yeah, we actually are, but that's because that conference had such a diverse array of topics, you know, ranging from diabetes to colon cancer to Canadian Indigenous peoples. I mean, we could probably recap each debate without getting overly repetitive.
It definitely made planning the 2015 ISGP conference in North Dakota really exciting.
Right, so let's do it. Which policy position paper is up for discussion today?
All right, now that I have your permission, today's paper is titled Building Local Food Capacity as a Food Security Strategy for Northern Indigenous Communities. And it was written and debated by Dr. Michael Robidoux, a professor at the University of Ottawa in Canada.
Getting international, I like it.
Cleo, we're always international. I'm in London. Hello.
Whatever, you know what I mean. Now, when it comes to today's topic, well, we're going to be brushing up along a similar topic that we discussed in episode 32, Arctic fish to fry, because the big underlying theme of Dr. Robidoux's paper involves roadblocks preventing Indigenous peoples in Canada from obtaining traditional or land-based foods.
Right, because thousands of years before food transportation was improved and food processing became a thing, you know, what we call food westernization, Canada's Indigenous populations subsisted on animal and plant foods procured from, well, all around them.
Historically, and even regionally, these groups had diverse dietary patterns. Some primarily consumed meats, while others focused more on plant products. Nowadays, at least over the last 30-ish years, these Indigenous populations, or First Nations as they're called in Canada, have had an easier time accessing poor quality processed foods.
And when you say accessing, you mean both in terms of physical proximity and financial cost, right?
Right. The limited options in many Northern Canadian food stores provide way more diversity when it comes to candy, sodas, and other processed foods compared to nutritious alternatives.
And the result of this food access disparity might not be surprising to you. Namely, Indigenous communities in Northern Canada tend to face higher rates of chronic disease, like obesity and type 2 diabetes, than non-Indigenous Canadians in other communities.
Actually, Northern Canada's Indigenous groups boast higher rates of obesity and T2D than not just the national average, but also the Indigenous national average. In other words, when it comes to Indigenous health disparities in Canada, those Northern populations are getting the very tip of the short end of the stick. Basically just a twig.
The toothpick, if you will.
No, we're not talking deforestation today. Anyway, Dr. Robidoux puts a really practical and admittedly grim spin on things. He's a health researcher. It's what he does. And he's part of a larger community of scientists doing this type of work. And he points out on, let's see, page 2 of his policy position paper, that doing this research is clearly not enough to have an impact.
Wow, talk about keeping one's self-importance in check.
Yeah, I definitely know some scientists who could learn from his reality check. But in any case, he says that these research results really aren't telling people things they don't already know. I know, it's a shocker, people, but these communities really can tell that they're suffering from tragic health outcomes.
Wow, that got dark pretty quickly. On a lighter note...
Wait, pun intended.
What pun?
We were talking about health impacts, like obesity, and then you said, on a lighter note.
Did not realize I did that. Anyway, ignoring you. On a lighter note, different communities are finding different ways to respond to these food access challenges by restoring connections to the land and looking ahead to locally sourcing more food, among others. And this was a big focus of Dr. Robidoux's paper and debate. Heck, even his own research.
Yeah, in his own research studying and supporting land-based food programs in northern Canada, the first thing he realized was that communities need to have ownership of their own food solution projects.
This includes making sure that the projects meet the end nutritional goal of the specific community, not goals of the outsiders, aka researchers, and that the projects are carried out via protocols that are accepted by the community.
Meaning.
Meaning that communities which are adamant about protecting the environment don't have to compromise this value when it comes to finding a solution, for instance.
And the debaters wholly agreed, by the way. Plus, the communities themselves usually have the best idea of what they're actually lacking. The debaters specifically mentioned traditional knowledge, infrastructure building, community freezers, and food preservation capacity as four examples of areas that are often wanting improvements.
Okay, got it. Go on.
But when it came down to it, Dr. Robidoux was able to observe food procurement projects in nine different First Nation communities in northern Canada, and each of these communities had their own strategies and goals.
All right, so let's give a few examples of some of these strategies. The debaters discussed how programs that bring food from southern Canada into more remote and rural areas in the north are helping with food security there. We're talking things like food box programs and co-ops.
Community markets and gardens are other options that have also been finding some success.
Food sharing programs, too.
Yeah, well, kind of.
Oh, okay, right. You're talking about the reciprocity thing?
Yeah, well, food sharing programs work better in communities where the concept of sharing is not traditionally based on reciprocity.
In communities where reciprocity is the basis of sharing, the groups are typically exclusive, so giving food outside of the group is considered charity. And the people who are most food insecure are usually outside of these groups in the first place, because to be in the group requires people to be able to hunt or otherwise procure food, so that you have food to share.
And when it comes to the food initiatives and communities that Dr. Robidoux studied, funding went toward developing the food procurement infrastructure that was lacking, but it also was funneled towards training younger generations in local harvesting and food preparation techniques, as well as providing nutritional and cooking information.
But a policy suggestion made by our presenter actually addressed this outreach to younger generations when he called out the 2014 First Nations Education Act, which is supposed to help close the educational gap experienced by on-reserve Indigenous folks.
And Aubrey is calling this a call-out because Dr. Robidoux noted the controversy surrounding the act, since it tries to tell Indigenous people what sort of education they need without explicitly consulting them about it. But anyway, there is an opportunity here.
Specifically, there's an opportunity to shape or at least modify the curriculum put forth by this legislation so that younger generations would be guaranteed to learn land-based food procurement strategies, including how to work the land, hunt, and cook food like their ancestors did.
BRB guys, gotta go move to Northern Canada so I can learn to cook.
Wait, you've been living in Princeton for how long now?
I like restaurants, and Princeton's got a lot of restaurants.
Well, arguably, more important than your diet, Aubrey, is the fact pointed out by debaters that a lot of traditional knowledge has been lost over time in North America, especially knowledge pertaining to the benefits of eating off the land. Everything from food procurement to preparation to even the buzzword sharing.
And one of the reasons this knowledge is being lost is because educational opportunities in remote Indigenous communities are sparse. So kids are often sent away to school, making it even less likely that they'll learn traditional practices.
I mean, if we want to go this route, the problems keep piling up. When these kids are sent away to school, they often experience culture shock and actually don't perform well. When they return home to their local communities, they're less likely to participate in those communities.
Giving them, once again, less opportunity to learn the cultural practices. But isn't it argued that younger generations actually don't like traditional foods very much?
Yeah, but how can we say that if they've never had any real opportunity to eat them?
Fair point. So, what about homeschooling then?
Tried and often failed, but what has been working a bit is local schools bringing in community elders so that students can interact and learn how traditions are passed along.
And when it comes to food traditions, the important part that food plays in pretty much any culture means that this knowledge is important not just for nutritional purposes, but also straight up cultural ones.
Right. And it's not just the fact that food is intrinsically linked with culture, but also the idea that traditional foods specifically incorporate customs such as ethical codes about the treatment of plants, spiritual connections between land and food, and medicinal applications of certain foods. The debaters even noted a global economic incentive for protecting these traditions and traditional lands when it comes to medical applications. But that's a little bit off topic.
So let's keep teaching these individuals how to get and prepare their food the way their ancestors did.
So while projects like Dr. Robidoux's have made strides in recording community efforts to improve local food outlooks, it's important to recognize that ensuring food access and quality doesn't necessarily mean that everyone in that area will magically adopt good dietary habits. Like in Aubrey's case, she has the means to go grocery shop and cook good food for herself, but Smashburger is just a deliciously worthy competitor.
Call out much? What Daniela meant by that totally unnecessary comment is that it's not enough to just document how communities are ensuring food access and quality. It's necessary to look at how these community actions are impacting individual behaviors. So, if I carry the metaphor, I am paid as a graduate student so that I can feed myself, but whether I go to a restaurant or cook in my kitchen is an entirely individual decision. Shut up, Daniela.
All right.
By analyzing individual behaviors, it will then be possible to determine whether even small dietary improvements are in turn positively influencing health outcomes.
And while it sounds pretty intuitive that dietary improvements and better food sources should result in better health, that connection in these communities isn't necessarily clear. Debaters mentioned that a study comparing diets comprised of processed store-bought foods compared to ones made up of, you know, land-based alternatives did not necessarily dictate the individual's health.
Specifically, this study noted that 33% of participants were diabetic, 98% were overweight, and 67% were obese, regardless of whether they land-sourced their food or consumed processed varieties.
But then there are other studies that suggest traditional diets are better for health, and regardless, are requested by indigenous consumers.
So the moral of the story is, as Dr. Robidoux pointed out, if these local food initiatives can be empirically tied to reductions in chronic disease incidence in these communities, then support for these programs is more likely to continue.
So, how do we make this happen? Connecting the community projects to improve food access to maybe improve dietary choice and then health outcomes?
Well, first of all, let me congratulate you on what was probably just the most succinct summary of what we've been discussing for the past 10 minutes. Second of all, I'm glad you asked. Happily, our presenter got pretty specific with his policy suggestions.
Right. And his first suggestion, Dr. Robidoux brought up hunter support programs, like the Income Security Program for Cree hunters and trappers. This is a program that gives money to families who spend at least 120 days harvesting local foods.
He explained that local food initiatives like this one are currently supported at the regional and provincial levels, mentioning food system projects in Manitoba and British Columbia. But at the same time, he claimed that federal support for cross-country local food initiatives is needed.
In another policy suggestion, Dr. Robidoux summarizes some of the reasons why wild food availability in parts of Canada might be dwindling, such as climate change, overfishing, and overhunting.
For a more thorough discussion of these and other factors, definitely check back at episode 32, which we mentioned earlier.
And in this paper, the summary boils down to this. Indigenous people trying to hunt or fish for food are often competing with sport and commercial hunters and fishers. Because of this, policies ensuring Indigenous people's access to these resources as needed are super necessary, while enforcement of existing policies in this area really needs to be ramped up.
And that as-needed access for First Nations also means limiting the commercial and sport hunters and fishers so that animals are actually present to be hunted or fished when Indigenous people need them.
While that sounded overly complicated, I see your point. You basically can't be assured access to things that just don't exist.
But wait, let's be fair, or rather, I guess, let's let the debaters be fair here. They mentioned that one reason that resource depletion has been occurring is because semi-nomadic groups are more frequently bunkering down into settlements, drawing on resources in confined spaces. That's all. Just wanted to make sure it was said.
All right. So there have also been instances in the world in which commercial groups partnering with local communities have been used to reverse resource depletion. For instance, the debaters mentioned an agreement between the Atlantic Salmon Federation and Native people in which the Federation purchases drift nets from local communities.
This partnership has required cooperation between sport fishermen and Native groups, and it's been implemented in parts of Greenland, Iceland, Russia, and the Gold Peninsula.
It's actually resulted in the restoration of natural fish stocks. So put a one in the win column when it comes to policies and partnerships that incorporate indigenous peoples.
This also seems a natural place to work in a discussion of resource extraction in northern Canada. We're talking things like mining and oil extraction here, which has been overly controversial due to the possibility of these companies encroaching on indigenous land and resources.
Yeah, and if you're a fan of popular media, you'd probably think there's no place for oil and mining companies coming in and striking deals with indigenous communities.
However, Dr. Robidoux is opportunistic, maybe even optimistic. He explains that negotiations between these companies and First Nations are focusing on pointing out the possible job opportunities and economic development that could benefit the local communities. But if these negotiations were paired with, say, financial commitments to improve the local environment and help build local food initiatives...
Oh, okay. I totally get that. That's interesting for sure. If companies are already promising things to be able to use the land, why not incorporate this food issue in there? I mean, we already talked about how constant financial support from the national government would be necessary. Why not supplement it with these company funds?
Yeah, I think that's the idea here. But the debaters acknowledge that that's way easier said than done. Not because the companies aren't willing to negotiate, but because not all First Nations councils feel empowered to have the discussions in the first place.
Not only that, but our astute debate table also pointed out that there's currently little environmental remediation support coming from the large companies that already exist on or near Indigenous lands. And this, first and foremost, needs to be rectified, because if we hope that Indigenous people can spend more time getting food from the land, it'd help if that food wasn't contaminated from industrial pollutants.
I guess this all leads to an important question about funding local food initiatives then. At this point, we've mentioned that federal government needs to support this, and that we can use extraction partnerships to do the same, but we can't let government off the hook that easily.
Oh no, not here on the forum. We ask the hard-hitting questions.
Yeah, like the question, where is the federal government getting this money, huh?
Well, Dr. Robidoux had an answer to that too. He mentions that, with the world, and Canada included, facing pressure to reduce carbon emissions, Canada will, quote, inevitably lead to more progressive and substantial carbon taxation, end quote.
And in case you're like me and wondering if that English does in fact mean that regions in Canada have adopted carbon taxes already, the answer is yes. British Columbia instituted its own carbon tax in 2008, becoming the first in North America. Several other Canadian provinces have followed suit, and now politicians from major parties across Canada are calling for national versions.
Okay, so assuming Dr. Robidoux's assertion is correct, and we do in fact see these carbon taxes popping up across Canada, he then thinks that a percentage of these tax revenues should go toward building and sustaining land-based food initiatives.
Wait, hold up.
In the regions that have been most heavily impacted by the fossil fuel industry.
Okay, that makes more sense. So the regions where land resources have been depleted because of fossil fuels.
Yeah, exactly. So we could possibly have funding coming from certain federal taxes.
In the end, the debaters agreed that researchers and institutions seeking to help Indigenous communities by offering food solutions must be careful not to impose. Advocating for a 100% traditional diet is also ineffective, even if at first glance, or first thought, I guess, it sounds like what we should be striving for. Completely traditional diets aren't always more sustainable or healthier.
That seems like a solid closing statement. So let's wind down today's conversation, shall we?
I think we discussed some pretty profound things today. To summarize, local food procurement strategies need to be emphasized, but only in such a way that works for the actual people who will be doing the food procuring.
After these strategies are developed, they need to be analyzed to determine whether having healthier food options actually results in healthier dietary choices.
And then finally, it needs to be determined, once and for all, whether improved diets actually result in better health outcomes, addressing the many chronic illnesses running rampant in northern Canada's Indigenous populations.
Are you part of an Indigenous community? What localized strategies would work best for your community?
We've raised many issues on behalf of our debaters, ranging from ways to engage in and teach the younger generations of Indigenous groups, to working with mining and oil companies to support these local food initiatives.
Please do let us know your thoughts on these issues by communicating with us on Twitter at ISGP Forum, or on Facebook if you prefer, at facebook.com/ISGP Forum.
Thank you for choosing to socialize the science today, and we hope you learned something about this very important and not often spoken about issue. See you in 2 weeks for our next episode right here on the forum.
The Institute on Science for Global Policy, or ISGP, is a nonprofit organization that convenes international meetings bringing together scientists, policymakers, industry leaders, students, and other stakeholders to discuss pertinent scientific issues facing society. The ISGP has no opinions and does not lobby. Therefore, the preceding podcast reflects the views expressed by the presenters and debaters at our conference. For more information, please visit our website at www.scienceforglobalpolicy.org. Thank you.